Hello and welcome back to Your Politics Show here on Mix 92.6 FM. This is Your Politics Show because we talk about national and local issues, but the main thrust of the conversation is directed by your questions that you send in all through the month, and we put them to the local politicians. We try to get the best answers and help with local issues. So do remember, before we get into the show, that you can email in at any time if you have any questions to put to our Labour, Liberal Democrat or Conservative MPs, and we will answer them through our social media or through our emails. This week, we are talking to Daisy Cooper, the MP for St Albans. So welcome back to the show, Daisy. We're going to start with what Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has said is the priority of his government right now, to stop boats crossing the channel. First of all, Daisy, what would the Lib Dems do to solve this issue?
Well, it's good to be back. I hope you're well. I guess on this issue, what I'd say is that it's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking seeing people trying to cross the channel. And I think everybody wants to see an end to it happening because it's just so devastating to see. And I really do find it so difficult to think about how desperate some people must be to make that really difficult journey, often with, you know, small babies and children as well. So we have got to stop the boats crossing, but we've got to do it in a way that is compassionate and fair. And that's what I think the government is failing to do. So the very first thing we would do is we would reopen some of the safe and legal routes by which asylum seekers could apply to come to this country. And over the last few years, the Conservative government have closed down lots of these safe and legal routes. And it therefore means that unless you originate from two or three specific countries, it's almost impossible for you to get here, even if you have family links. And that's why so many desperate people are resorting to crossing the boats in that way. So that's the first thing we would do. And that would reduce the number of people who are legitimate asylum seekers applying to come to the UK. The second thing we would do is that we would scrap this awful Rwanda replacement scheme and spend that funding on processing the claims. Now, back in 2015, the Home Office processed about 26,000 claims within a 6-month period, which was about 26,000 claims processed within the 6-month target. So 78% of claims were dealt with within 6 months. In 2019, that dropped to just 3,600 cases, so just less than 7% of the total. Because the Home Office is in such a mess and they cannot deal with the applications that are coming in, that's why we're having to, that's why the government is choosing to spend taxpayers' money on putting people in hotels. And that's really difficult for local communities. It has a knock-on impact on the local economy as well, because obviously if you have people in hotels, it means you can't use those hotels to attract visitors and tourism, but it also means we're spending taxpayers' money supporting people to stay in these hotels. And so it's a lose-lose situation. So we would, as I say, we would have safe and legal routes for those people who are applying to come here, who seek safe harbour. We would invest in processing the claims much faster so that we don't have this enormous backlog. And we would also fill the Modern Slavery Commissioner post, which has lay empty for several months now. And the reason this is important is because many people who come here are often brought so by people who are involved in criminal gangs. And those people are forced to work against their will in horrific conditions. And the government hasn't taken anything like the kind of action it needs to take to crack down on those bad employers. And I think the first step to doing that is to appoint a modern slavery commissioner and create that kind of employment body that's going to tackle those unscrupulous employers. So a number of things that we would do.
Just on this issue, the government frequently links the issue of boat crossing and being unable to do things to having to leave the European Court of Human Rights. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I mean, the major problem we have here is that when we left the EU, the government also scrapped the returns policy that we had with other EU countries, where you could return people to the first country Where they had entered at the European Union. And because they haven't replaced that, we've got many people coming here. The government likes to come up with all sorts of reasons, all sorts of other people to blame for their failures. But the real truth here is that the government has completely lost a grip on the Home Office. The Home Office have lost a grip on the application process. As I say, in 2015, 26,000 claims were processed within 6 months. 2019, just 3,600. That's got nothing to do with the ECJ. This has got everything to do with the fact that the government has completely, lost, completely failed to deal with the Home Office and the applications that are coming in. It's just government incompetence.
So would leaving the ECHR possibly make the situation worse?
To be honest, I haven't looked into this issue, and I don't know whether it make it better or worse. But I think it's what I would say is that argument is irrelevant to what we're dealing with. The problem we've got here is they've got a Home Office department that has got itself in a right old muddle. We've got a Home Secretary who can't manage her department. We've got thousands and thousands and thousands of people applying for asylum here in the country, and they just can't deal with the backlog of applications. So rather than trying to set up a very expensive scheme whereby we'd send people abroad, which has, I think is very expensive and probably is very immoral, they should be spending that money by investing it into processing the claims that we've got from people who are arriving here on our shores. That's the way to deal with it.
Another topic that has been surrounded with heated discussion this month is that Shamima Begum has lost her appeal over the decision to remove her British citizenship. Do you believe that this was the right decision?
Do you know what? I completely understand why people are angry and concerned about Shamima Begum and anybody who's been involved in a terrorist group. But I think this was the wrong decision. I mean, fundamentally, she's British, right? She's British. And therefore, that means that whether we like it or not, she's our problem. And we can have a debate about what we do about that, whether she should be in prison, whether there needs to be high security, whether at some point in the future there needs to be a surveillance on her links and all those kind of things. But I think this particular decision sets a very dangerous precedent. And I also think that, had Shamima Begum been white and had she had an Anglo-Saxon name, I think it's highly unlikely that the government would have considered revoking her citizenship. So, I mean, there are very strict parameters in place as to when somebody can have their citizenship revoked, and it does include some terrorist activity. But I just think that it's a very difficult issue. I think fundamentally revoking someone's citizenship is, I think, something that really, shouldn't happen unless there are incredibly, incredibly exceptional circumstances. And the truth of the matter here is that she was 15. That makes, when she, got involved in that group, that does mean that she was a child. And I think that we need to take some responsibility as a state to say, yeah, she's a British child and she's our responsibility. And I would hate to think that any young woman from St Albans or anywhere else in the country that was caught up in the wrong activity would somehow be at risk of losing their citizenship. So I find it very disturbing. And as I say, we can have a discussion about how we protect ourselves and what surveillance or prison sentence needs to be applied to her for her activities. But I feel deeply uncomfortable about the fact that her citizenship has been revoked.
Do you believe this as well sends a worrying message to people who may have foreign descendants or links to abroad that citizenship is now conditional, and linked to that, a fair trial is conditional, fair treatment is conditional? Is that a fair situation?
I hope very much that that is not the situation, but I have seen people raising those concerns in public discourse. Time will tell, unfortunately, whether or not that is the case. I hope very much that that is not the case, but the fact that some people now feel that that could be the case, it sounds very dangerous, dangerous warning to all of us. And I think it's incumbent on those of us who are in power to hold the government to account to make sure that that is not the case. But as I say, I've seen people raising those concerns. And, I think if Shamima Begum had been white with an Anglo-Saxon name, I do think that the government may have made a very different decision. And as a result, I understand why people are saying this.
This week, we have seen some supermarkets rationing certain foods due to shortages. The situation has been explained that it's due to weather issues. However, British farmers have said the issue has been made worse by the government not giving local growers enough support. And evidence shows that Europe is not having similar levels of problems. Daisy, what needs to be done to rectify this issue?
Well, today, the Liberal Democrats have called on the government to have a COBRA meeting to sort out these issues over the next few weeks. Fundamentally, there are three issues here. The first is the bad weather. And when there's extreme weather, I think in many parts of Europe, they went from a sort of summer to a winter very quickly without an autumn. And that means that they didn't manage to grow as much fruit and veg as they might have otherwise have done. The second is the spiralling energy costs. And, you know, the government hasn't capped energy costs as much as they have in other countries. And therefore, many British farmers decided not to grow tomatoes and other fruit and veg in the kind of the warm houses because they couldn't afford to warm them up. So that also means that we didn't grow our own crops either in this regard. And then the third element is that there's a bit of, you know, Brexit has had a bit of an impact in this situation as well, because it's just more costly for suppliers to get their goods to the UK. And that's why other parts of Europe are not seeing the same problem on the same kind of level. In Ireland, for example, and they are getting fruit and veg, but they are having some problems there. So they're a bit of a halfway house. So their situation isn't as bad as in Great Britain. Their situation is better than Great Britain, but not as bad as other parts of Europe. So yeah, there are three issues here. And I think the government's really got to get a grip and talk to suppliers about what can be sorted out. I hope, however, that this could be sorted in the next few weeks, because obviously when the weather gets warmer, we'll move into the kind of seasonal produce of the spring. So hopefully this issue won't go on for too long.
Turning it to your own party, this month the Lib Dems set out ideas for helping social care with a plan for higher pay for social care staff. You believe that this will help staff shortage issues. How is this going to be paid for, though, Daisy?
Well, in short, what we've said is that you could pay for this by raising a levy on the gaming industry. The gaming industry did incredibly well during the pandemic and continues to do so. And there've been all sorts of arguments for a very long time about putting a mandatory levy on the gaming industry to pay for all sorts of things. And what we've said is that we would like to use that levy to pay specifically to increase the minimum wage for social care workers so that their minimum wage is at least £2 higher than everybody else. The reason for this is that our social care in this country is in complete crisis, and carers are leaving social care to work in warehouses, to work in supermarkets, sometimes to work in retail, sometimes even to work in the NHS, because the pay is so much better and the conditions are better. And therefore, if we want to sort out care, which we need to do, because if we don't sort out care, we can't sort out the NHS. If we want to sort out care, then we're going to have to attract people to come to the industry and stay in the industry. And one of the major ways of doing that is to increase their pay.
Let's move it to local issues now. And many have messaged in wanting to know, are there any updates on the Fight the Freight campaign?
So not yet, but there will be very soon. So some people will know that there was a big public meeting in Chiswell Green not long ago, where I kind of gave an update on where we were with the campaign. Fundamentally, we're still fighting the county council to try and persuade them that actually they don't have an obligation to sell the land. The latest update from them was that they agreed they would get new legal advice. And I've been told by Hertfordshire County Council that they are awaiting that legal advice, but we should have it in the next few days. I also know that the Fight the Freight campaign themselves are also about to instruct some lawyers on some points of legal contention. And so they're taking some legal action as well. So that's where things are at for now. But hopefully by the next time we have a conversation, there should be a significant update.
Interesting. Yes, you'll be back again next month, hopefully with news on that issue. But earlier this month, you met staff and students at Heathland School and joined in with the National Deaf Children's Society Purple Bus Roadshow. What did you learn from this experience?
Yeah, it was fascinating. I think Heathland School is really fantastic. It's, a real leading school for teaching deaf children. And the National Deaf Children's Society have this purple bus that goes around the country, and they go to deaf schools and work with the students on their kind of personal development and their skills and leadership and well-being and all sorts of things. I guess there were two things that jumped out at me. The first is that many deaf children do struggle with mental health. I think mental health issues are more prevalent because, unfortunately, we live in a society where we're not very disability aware as a society, and therefore it's hardly surprising that those that do have a disability often feel excluded, and therefore that can have an impact on their mental health. And the other thing was that the children in particular were incredibly keen to try and start a deaf club. And there was a bit of a conversation going on about whether they wanted the deaf club just to be for them, so that they could just have fun with each other and have some sort of fun social time after school. And other children said they'd like other people who are not deaf to come in and join them, so they can sort of see how deaf children play and socialize and hopefully learn a bit of sign language. So there was a bit of a debate going, and as a politician, I love a bit of a debate. So I was encouraging them to debate amongst themselves how they wanted this new deaf club to work, and invited them to contact me in case I can help and support them to get it going.
Now, an issue that we've had quite a lot of people message in about is that the district council wants to start charging residents to go to Verulamium Museum from April. And I think there was a vote on that yesterday. So maybe you'll be able to kind of give us an update on that. But also many wrote in with concerns over the fact that the district council are going to start charging for car parking at leisure centres across the area too. First of all, what is the latest on this? And also, will you oppose these measures if they try and bring them in?
So the first thing to say is that I don't have a vote on any of these measures because they're a district council decision. And I had raised concerns with councillors and asked why these measures were being considered. And the answer was pretty clear. Time and time again, central government has cut the budget of local councils. They're doing this right across the country. The mini budget, of course, blew a massive hole in the nation's economy, but also in local council budgets as well. And there is a legal requirement that every local district council provides a balanced budget, and there are some core services that they absolutely have to deliver. And unfortunately, the government, whilst the government considers planning and bin collections as statutory responsibilities that councils have to deliver, they don't consider museums or leisure facilities as being a statutory responsibility. So that means they're discretionary, and the council can only provide them if they have the funds to do so. So unfortunately, this does mean that there's had to be some very difficult decisions to ensure that we can provide a balanced budget. What I can say is that on the side of the museum, the district council has been very proactive about trying to raise funds to support the museum. They were successful in raising £1 million from a sort of national sort of competition to invest in our museums, and that's a really significant achievement. And it also means that our museums will now get the recognition as being, some of the best in the country. So that is really, really important. But fundamentally, this comes down to the fact that, central government continues to cut local government budgets. I've raised that in government since 2015. The budgets, both for St Albans District Council and Three Rivers District Council, have both been cut by more or less 22%. And if somebody cuts your budget by, more than a fifth, it's just not possible to provide the same services. So our district council is determined to protect valuable local services and to make sure that we have a functioning council that can balance its budget. But it's just really unfortunate that they've had to make these kind of difficult decisions.
When I spoke to Bim Athalami on this same issue, he explained that he thought it was because people had voted for a Lib Dem county, a district council. And he said, if you'd voted for the Conservatives, this wouldn't have happened. Do you think that that's not correct? That maybe people need to have sympathy, that things have to be cut, have to be changed? Like you said, there needs to be a balancing of the budget, and maybe the blame is elsewhere.
I don't think people need to be, I'm not going to tell people how they should feel. I mean, if people are angry about it, then I would encourage them to direct their anger at the government. I mean, you know, it's all very well Bim saying that the Conservative wouldn't have done this, but at the budget last night, the Conservative councillors, because there are still some Conservative councillors at the district council, they didn't table any amendments. They didn't make any suggestions as to different decisions that could have been made. And so where are their ideas? You know, ultimately, every district council, whoever they are run by, whether it's Liberal Democrat, Labour, Conservative, or anybody else, they have to produce a balanced budget. And if the local Conservatives were serious about that proposal, that they wouldn't have to make any cuts anywhere, then they could have put down some amendments to the Liberal Democrat budget. And I'm certain that the Lib Dems would have considered any reasonable amendments as to how to make different decisions. But because they didn't do that, it's clearly just, you know, it's just posturing.
So the last question before we get to the community questions is the Department for Transport data shows that Hertfordshire County has had a 56.5% reduction in bus mileage since 2017, the highest in England. With the goal of tackling climate change in the mind and creating a greener economy, surely this is a worrying step in the wrong direction for the area, Daisy.
It is. It's really worrying. You know, we need to have better routes for walking, cycling, public transport, buses and trains. You know, there should be an absolute revolution in using public transport. And it's pretty shocking, isn't it, that not only are we the absolute worst in England for having cuts to our bus services, according to the government's own data, but who's the Secretary of State for Transport been for a long time? Well, it's been Grant Shapps, hasn't it? An MP from Hertfordshire. So, I mean, it's pretty shocking that not only is the Secretary of State, actually lives in the county that's had the biggest cuts to its bus services. I mean, it's really, really shocking. And we should all be angry about this. We really should, partly because public transport in and of itself is a good thing. You know, it helps, it makes, gives us more an inclusive society. It gives us more transport options, but it is also the right thing to do to tackle the climate emergency. So it's just, you know, I saw this data this week, and it's just another thing to be cross about, isn't it, really, in terms of the way the government is managing things in Hertfordshire.
Well, just a follow-up question then. In Hertfordshire, the county council subsidise the bus services up to about £4 million a year. 95% of bus operators are commercial. So with, you know, we've discussed there the aforementioned need to create more public transport, would it be a good idea to, you know, make these in national ownership, nationalise the bus routes? Because many routes do not make a profit, but they serve as a massive public good. One lady was interviewed this week and, you know, there's hardly any people on their bus route, but it serves as an absolute necessity for her to get to, you know, to the local bank or to go shopping or even go to her medical meetings. And so, you know, she's having to look to move just because there's no bus route to her area anymore. I mean, does this mean that public transport needs to be publicly owned?
So, I mean, I always find it interesting that people always think that if you nationalise things, it's going to suddenly get better. I mean, as a Liberal, I always think the concentration of power is the wrong thing to do, whether that's in the private sector, whether that's in the hands of the state or anywhere else. What you want to do is empower individuals to affect things in their lives. And actually what I would like to see, I don't think you'd need to nationalise buses necessarily, but I would like to see a lot more buses in Hertfordshire. And one way you could do that would be to go back to the old system where the routes that are not, the routes that are very, very popular and are used very well are the ones that subsidise the other routes that are not used so well, but which are essential for a small number of people. That scheme used to be set up. That used to be the way that everything worked. A local authority would have a conversation with a bus company about providing for a group of routes, not just an individual one. And that seemed to work really well. So there are ways of making the buses work without having an overall, without having an overhaul of the ownership issue.
Let's move to the community questions. Adam has opened it up by saying, why is the government allowing another increase to gas bills when prices have fallen 75% from the peak? Sunak always has a non-answer, and it seems like pure greedy profiteering.
So prices are now starting to fall, which is a relief, but unfortunately they're still five times higher than they have been on average in other years. And so yes, people are still going to get hit by massive increases in their bills. Liberal Democrats and others have called on the government to extend support to households and to businesses. And as yet, the government has refused to do that. There is a budget coming up soon, so the government may still choose to provide some additional support, but they haven't done that yet. I think what also worries me is that whilst we need these kind of short-term solutions to protect people from these very volatile increases in prices, you know, we should have seen by now some action from the government to tackle the longer-term issues about energy storage and also about energy use. And Liberal Democrats have been saying for years and years and years that we need to have an emergency programme of home insulation so people live in warm homes that are of a decent standard that reduces our energy use overall. And that hasn't happened. And as a result, here we are now into the second year of cost of living crisis, and the government is still yet to actually produce any measures on this whatsoever.
Would that be similar to the Italian retrofitting of insulation? Is that the kind of scheme that you'd go for?
I've got absolutely no idea what happens in Italy, but we have said for a long time that it would be a program of home insulation that would be retrofitting, and it would be starting with those people living in fuel poverty, essentially. So those people who can least afford to put their heating on should be the ones who are the first ones to benefit from the home insulation.
I might have to send that info over to you, Daisy, about sure. Italy. Callum has said recent data shown St. Albans has the third most expensive new build homes in comparison to local income. Why aren't the council doing more to ensure the builds are more affordable? Is that even a council issue, Daisy? I don't know the ins and outs of that.
In essence, no. Basically, the council don't have any powers in this regard other than to require that up to 40% of homes are affordable. And the council, you know, where it has the funds, will buy land to build its own social homes. But fundamentally, this is a private market, and it's a private market that's completely broken. Now, one of the major problems, there's lots of reasons why the system is broken, but I'll just give you one brief example. We know that over the last few years, some former office blocks have been converted into flats. And flats are often a really great place for people to start off. They're often great starter homes where, you know, individuals or couples might live as their first flat before sort of maybe starting a family and moving to a bigger home. But first of all, these offices were turned into flats under government regulations that don't require any contribution from those developers into the funds that help us get all the relevant services. So these big developers were turning offices into flats, but without having to pay for the additional GPs or school places or road building or any of that kind of stuff that would need to go with it. And so that's one sort of major problem. The second problem is that at the moment, local councils don't have any powers at all to regulate how many second homes or buy-to-lets there can be in the local area. Now, I think that should change. I think local councils should have those powers. But because they don't, what we found is that there are often quite a lot of new places being built in St. Albans, but they're getting bought up by people to have as buy-to-lets or as Airbnbs. Now, if you've got a block of flats and say it has, you know, for argument's sake, let's say it's got 120 apartments in it, that's 120 apartments that could be 120 homes for people who want to live in St. Albans and build a life here. But if half of them or all of them are effectively Airbnbs, that might be great for tourism, but it's terrible for people who want to rent here. So at the moment, because St. Albans is a very desirable place to live and work because it's so lovely, I mean, that's great on the one hand, but at the moment, local councils, local authorities simply don't have the powers they need to regulate the housing market in the local area.
Paula has turned her attention to road closures. She said, there's so many at the moment, it's confusing for me to drive. The other day, Catherine Street was closed and now it's open. Is there a way the council keeps us up to date on when these things are shut, or have I missed something? So I don't know if there is, easily sourceable information for people like Paula, Daisy.
It's a very good question. So obviously highways are a Hertfordshire County Council issue, so nothing to do with the district council. And I do sympathise because this often catches me out, and it's very infuriating when you've got to do a quick journey and you need to get across town and you don't know that a particular road is going to be closed. So it is infuriating. So I do sympathise. As I say, it's a Hertfordshire County Council issue. I'm not aware of any kind of facility where you can sign up to ask for notifications about closures in your area, but I think I did see a tweet about this from Chris White, who is Paula's county councillor. So the best advice I have for now is to either follow him on social media or perhaps email him and ask him or convey her views to him so that Chris can convey those views to Hertfordshire County Council.
Kerry has said, my friends and I have been sent parking fines by the station car park despite paying via the app. This has happened to about 10 friends I know a few times now. The fines were cancelled after I showed them a proof of paying. But my worry is that this is a waste of money sending out incorrect letters, and also people who aren't as savvy may just pay up. This doesn't seem right. I mean, is this an issue that you've been made aware of at all, Daisy?
Yeah, I'm aware of this, and a number of people have written to me about it. And I think from what Kerry said, this is actually the car park that's run by, it's actually a sort of, Thameslink has got a contractor that runs the car park, but it's actually station land. It's not anything to do with either of the local councils. I mean, I know it's incredibly frustrating for people and very time consuming to have to, you know, submit the evidence, etc. All I could suggest to Kerry is that they ask their friends to drop me a line with their kind of experience of what's happened, and then I can raise it directly with Network Rail and Thameslink and ask them what the hell's going on.
Michael has moved it to a big political issue. He says, I'm disappointed at the lack of Remain voices in current political discussions. Brexit has been an obvious shambles, he says. Why are the Lib Dems not pushing hard and putting pressure to re-enter the EU? What do you say to Michael, Daisy?
Well, I guess there would be two things I would say. The first thing I would say is that I've been very clear about our position on this. You know, Liberal Democrats want the UK to be at the heart of Europe. We have a four-stage plan as to how we would develop that closer relationship. There are things we could do now, like tweaking the existing trade deal and joining various EU-wide programmes on science and education. And eventually we want to rejoin the single market. But why aren't we pushing for that right now? Well, unfortunately, I have to say to Michael, we have a Conservative government, and the Conservative government is hell-bent on ruining trust with the EU. And they're currently in the process of trying to rip up every single bit of EU legislation that we had previously agreed to. And Liberal Democrats have been active in Parliament at opposing and trying to block these attempts to rip up all these bits of EU law en masse. What we had called for, and we supported a cross-party movement within Parliament, where this cross-party amendment would have required the government to publish a complete list of every single welfare standard, food standard, working condition standard, every single piece of EU law they wanted to scrap, and then have parliamentary scrutiny of every single one to see what the impact would be on British law. But the government rejected that amendment, and they're hell-bent, as I say, on just trying to rip up all of this EU law, which provides at the moment the only protections we have to particular standards in food and working conditions and everything like that. So at the moment, you know, we are very active at blocking the government in its attempts to push us further apart from the EU. And we've set out our position, and I hope that many people vote for it at the next general election.
So we've got two quick final questions for you, Daisy. Sarah yes. says, after listening to your show last month, I want to know your latest fitness update.
The latest fitness update is that my kettlebell still looks at me most mornings wondering why it hasn't been picked up.
And it's a shame that you can't, you know, obviously it's on the radio so people can't see your kettlebell, but it's a very impressive one, I must say. And then Tony has asked, did you celebrate Pancake Day and what is your topping?
I'm gutted. I was in Parliament and they had American style pancakes, but didn't have any kind of thin ones. So I didn't get to celebrate Pancake Day this year. But if I had have done, I would have gone for Nutella and banana.
Oh, wow. See, now, you know, I don't want to break impartiality rules there, but I agree with you with the thinness of pancakes, and I agree with you on the topping there. So I hope I'm not going to get in trouble there for, you know, saying that I'm biased towards you at all, Daisy, because if Bim or Bambo said the same thing, I'd agree with them as well. But for now, we're going to wish you the best of health, and we will chat to you again next month. And I hope everybody found the information that we discussed very useful. But thank you very much for your time today, Daisy.
Thank you.